Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Sarah, and this is the It's Fine, I'm Fine podcast. Today, I am joined by Lee. Lee is amazing. She's the director at Gelt Charitable Foundation, which is a nonprofit that helps people feel less alone in their mental health journey. She's the director of education there, and she brings over 6 years of experience working with at-risk and suicidal youth. She has schooled over 5,000 people internationally in suicide prevention, which she'll talk about more today, but it's just incredible. What she's doing is amazing, and she lives in Philly, and she's also just like a really cool person. When we first spoke on the phone, before we recorded, we became like soul sisters. We literally were on the phone for an hour, and I thought it was going to be a 5-minute conversation. She's a ball of light, pretty much, and she's incredible, and she's done a lot to help with suicide prevention. I just want to issue a trigger warning. Of course, I know suicide is a triggering topic, so please proceed with caution. If this is hard for you, you know, we have resources if you need them, and definitely don't feel afraid to reach out if you need help. So with that, I will move into peak and pit of the week before I give you too much about Lee, because she will introduce herself. Peak and pit. Okay, my pit of the week was, I think that I just have been like really, really busy with work and social life that I have not had time to go grocery shopping. And if you saw my Instagram story, I had nothing in my refrigerator. And it's like funny until you realize that I end up with nothing to eat and I have to like run out and quickly grab the closest thing at CVS, which is like really sad. Of course, it could be worse. I have a privilege to live next to a CVS and get food at all. But it's tough. It's tough for me to find time for, you know, my things that are really important. In terms of my peak, I have been going into the office, and that's totally changed my mental health in a positive way. It's been awesome. And at first I was like really lazy and I didn't want to go in because I love my home working from home life. But do I really love it? No, I actually get like really sad on my couch all day alone. It's just tough to get up. But once you're there and you're dressed and you have a purpose, you're like, wow. And you're surrounded by other people. It feels really, really good. So that's been awesome. Going back to Lee, as I mentioned, she works in suicide prevention. She is the author of a book called Shattered Illusions. And she's a mother, she's a wife, she's a person, she is amazing. And I can't wait for you to hear this, so enjoy. Hey Lee, how's it going?
Hi Sarah, how are you?
welcoming Lee to the podcast here. So just for some background to the listeners, our mutual friend, Ethan Stein, who is like very popular on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, so you might know him, introduced us and thought it would be a good idea for us to talk. And then we chatted on the phone for like an hour last week.
It was like an hour and a half.
Yeah, it was like an hour and a half. And we just like, I thought it was going to be 5 minutes. I thought we were going to hop on the phone, talk about this podcast episode, and then hop off. And then an hour later, we're like, and then when I was five, like this. Like in 1992, you know, this is what I mean, I wasn't even born then, but.
Why? I'm older than you?
I was born in 94.
Oh, I was born in 91.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Little surprise there.
It's so much fun for me when I meet people who are younger than me who are so accomplished. I'm like, go you. You're amazing.
I don't feel accomplished, but that's imposter syndrome.
But you know what? Neither do I. I think no matter how much I've accomplished in my life, I always sit down. I do writing. I try to do writing, a writing practice every morning to like get my day started. That's like the good days. on the good days, I start my day with a writing practice. On my like less than good days, there's no writing practice. But if you would look at what is written inside my notebook most mornings, I mean, I have my notebook right here. I could read to you what I wrote this morning. It's like, I feel so antsy and jittery this morning. And I'm like questioning my role. And I'm wondering about like, am I going to be okay? Like, is this going to be okay? Is that going to be okay? And it's so funny, no matter how many goals I hit in my life, I always find myself, yes, feeling so grateful, and then also coming back to like, oh no, do I fit in? Am I like supposed to be here? Maybe I should go hide in the corner and let the professionals do this. So
yeah, that is actually exactly how I feel every single day. So why don't you tell the listeners about what you do, how you got into the mental health space? Because you also have a book, and that is more of an artistic route type thing, right? So why don't you tell us your background and tell us, like, you know, how you got into the mental health space?
Okay. So I am the director of the Gelt Charitable Foundation. We're a fairly new nonprofit. We've been around for about 2.5 years. And our main focus is suicide prevention and mental wellness education. So I'm a certified suicide prevention educator. I'm trained in crisis management. And I got into this role. I'm like trying to think. There's so many different pieces of my life that brought me to this role. But essentially, if I really hone it down, I never thought about becoming a mental health professional. I was always more of a creative. I am a published author. My first novel was published when I was 21. But I always had this interest in psychology. I always had an interest in people. I love people. I love people's minds. I love understanding people's minds. And about 6.5 years ago, in the job that I was working at the time, which was the creative director of C-Teen International, the Chabad Teen Network, I was exposed, if you could put it that way, I was exposed to the gravity at which suicide is affecting that particular population of teens. And like, I knew kind of in the periphery, in the back of my mind, that like suicide was a problem with teenagers and that it was an issue that was affecting a lot of people, but like, did it really have any particular standing in my life? Not so much. Until I was being faced with answering the teen, you know, speaking to the teens who I was close to, who were saying to me, well, my friend just died by suicide, or I'm having thoughts of suicide, or my sister's having thoughts of suicide, or my mom's having thoughts of suicide. And then they were coming to me for help. And I was like, wait a second. Not a mental health professional, not even trained to be able to do this. Why are you coming to me? Mm-hmm. And I realized that there was an opportunity here to do something and to meet people at their needs in a way that wasn't being done. Here's the thing about suicide prevention that I've come to learn. First of all, it's not something that's taught in clinical settings. Most grad school programs, most PhD programs do offer one class or two classes or three classes in crisis management, and that's it. So most mental health professionals walk into the world and get their experience of working with suicidal patients or clients in lived experience. Wow. So I, you know, when these things started to happen with my teens, and I should say, I mean, I should mention this. I think that the thing that really broadened my awareness of this issue was when a teen that I was very close to, who I thought I knew everything about, I spoke to her on a regular basis. She was on my editorial staff for the magazine I ran for C-Teen. I spoke to her all the time. We had, you know, we had a great relationship, great rapport. And at a weekend retreat, she pulled me aside and said to me, you know, I really need to talk to you. Then she starts sharing me with her. She was having thoughts of suicide. And I was like, wait, where are all the professionals who are supposed to know what to do? Right. Not me. And I realized that there were a lot of people who in theory knew what could be done in a situation like this. But when we were actually faced with a crisis right now, everyone kind of went like this. So right. I was put in this position where it was like, okay, I know this is going to sound maybe like a little bit egotistical, but in the place where there is no man, strive to be the man. So I was looking around, I'm like, wait, where are all the adults who are supposed to know what to do? And then it was like, oh, I'm the adult. I'm the one who's supposed to know what to do. So that led me to get certified as a safe talk educator. I became trained in crisis management. I actually went back to school after a 3-year hiatus. I left school in the middle of my undergrad because I was so burnt out. And so I was very disillusioned by the literary world, so decided to take a break from that and went back to school to complete my BA in psych. And I'm actually applying to grad schools now for clinical psychology. Clinical social work. So it's been, yeah.
That's awesome.
It's pretty wild.
It's an incredible journey. I want to say something that you made me think about was like, when it comes to friends sharing things with you, like, or friends thinking about suicidal ideation with you or with anyone in general, it just occurred to me that people probably feel more comfortable sharing those things with their closest friend or a parent more so than reaching out to a mental health professional, because they might not even know where to start with the mental health. Like, if you don't see a therapist or see a psychiatrist and you're having suicidal ideation, your first thought might not be like, let me find one, because it feels like a huge lift to like, now I have to go look for one. And it's like, where do I even go? So I feel like if you're having those thoughts and you want help, you might ask like your friend or your parent first before you go to a mental health professional. So it's really nice that you were able to kind of like get trained in that when you saw the need for it, you know?
And I'll tell you what is interesting that I've come to know, you know, I've been doing this now for 6 years. So the first 3 years was like flying by the seat of my pants, just figuring out how to help people with whatever resources I could access. And then I became certified about almost 3 years ago. And then so for the last 3 years, I've been doing this as my actual role in my job. Mm-hmm. Here's what we know. It is exactly what you said, Sarah. Most people who are struggling with suicidal thought are not going to approach a mental health professional. At least not immediately. Not mm-hmm. only because it's like, how do I even wrap my head around who to go to?
Right.
But the fear and the stigma associated with this issue stops people from accessing the help they need, because they're so afraid that they'll be hospitalized, that they'll be shunned from their community, that they won't mm-hmm. be allowed to work anymore. There's a lot of fear over what are the ramifications of me asking for help. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. So you know, that's one area of it. So what we do actually, or at least my main area of focus is actually not to train mental health professionals or to train psychologists or psychiatrists, even though I like doing that, but that's not where we're, you know, that's not our main focus. Our mm-hmm. main focus is to train the people who are on the ground, teachers, mm-hmm. educators, family members, parents, teens. We do a lot of teen trainings in schools, and usually people jump up and they're like, wait, Lee, isn't that a little dangerous to like train teens in suicide prevention? Mm-hmm. Like, isn't that going to trigger something for them?
Right.
And here's the thing, right? Teens are dealing with this issue whether we want to acknowledge it or not.
Right.
So we're doing them a disservice by not giving them the tools to be able to do something about this when inevitably their friends will come to them.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
So it just, you know, we really focus on gatekeeper community training, making sure that the average person who doesn't think that, you know, doesn't consider themselves a mental health professional, but just wants to be helpful. Anyone can have these tools. And it's mm-hmm. similar to being a lifeguard. You don't become a lifeguard without knowing CPR, and you hope you never have to use CPR on someone. But then when you do need to use it, you're really happy you have it. So that's what suicide prevention is like too. I always mm-hmm. say to people, I hope you never have to use these skills. I hope you never find yourself having to be in a situation where someone's in crisis. But inevitably you might find yourself in one.
Right, right. Do you, like, okay, a couple questions. A, did you start the Gelt Charitable Foundation?
So the Gelt Charitable Foundation, well, kind of. So basically, the Gelt Charitable Foundation is sponsored by and paid for Gelt Financial, which is run by Jack Miller, who is the president of the foundation. So a private sector organization that started a nonprofit. And Jack and I came together. We both kind of realized on our own separately that there was a major need, specifically in the Jewish community, to talk about this issue. Jack is Jewish, I'm Jewish. So we were seeing this issue specifically in our community. I actually didn't facilitate this training because I wasn't certified yet, but I had helped organize a couple of trainings in Florida for Chabad communities in Florida. And Jack heard about it and called somebody who called somebody who called somebody who connected him to me. And he was like, this is great. I want to help make this a global thing. So since I joined the foundation like 6 months into its inception. So Jack came up with the idea for the foundation. I was doing all the stuff on my own. We joined partner, you know, we joined forces, and 2.5 years later, I'm running the day-to-day logistics of the foundation, and I'm our lead trainer, and I write all of our curriculums, and I do all of our crisis management phone calls. So it's a lot, but I'm like, it's a role that I'm so beyond grateful to be in. And every day when I have an opportunity to be helpful in any way, I just, it changed my perspective on the way I see the world. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. You're extremely impressive. wait, so when you came up with the idea to get certified and start training, what were you were writing at the time?
I was working as the creative director at CTN International.
Okay. Right.
So this was probably about when I was about 23. I was 23 or 24. I'm 30 now. So this is when I was about 23. My novel had been published when I was 21. Which is like, so impressive, and it's so cool, and it's so amazing, and also it brought up so much work for me. Because, you know, at 21 years old, first of all, no one tells you what it's going to be like to publish a novel.
Is it really hard?
It's so hard, and it's so heart-wrenching, and it takes every ounce of energy out of you. And I say this to young aspiring writers, and I remind this to myself all the time, that the writing is where the joy is. The publishing is not where the joy is. The getting your face on the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times is amazing. And it happened to me. And it's a temporary fleeting moment. And then the next morning, I still had to wake up and be Lee and deal with all of my stuff and be a human being in this world. And it sucked, if I could put it bluntly.
Yeah. But, sorry, go ahead.
No, thank you. So funny. I don't feel that cool.
No, I'm like freaking out.
It also just goes to show, like, we're all human beings.
Yeah.
We're all people. And no matter how many amazing, incredible things we're doing, we each, every single morning when I wake up, I have to face myself in the mirror with all of my insecurities and all of my doubts and all of the mistakes that I've made. And it's a very hard thing to do.
Right.
Being right. in this role as an aspiring mental health professional and already in my role as a suicide prevention educator has forced me to face myself and my mental health in ways that I don't think would have been done had I not gotten into this role.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got certified, so crazy. I was running CTN International, like the back end curriculum development, training in new rabbis, working with teens, running CTN Shabbaton. This is a weekend retreat in New York that attracts 3,000 to 5,000 teens from around the world. And we were the only organization in New York City that was allowed to shut down Times Square outside of the Times Square Alliance.
Didn't that happen last night? Yeah, that was awesome.
This is only the second Shabbaton in the 13 or 14 years that CTN has been around that I was not somehow involved in.
Wow.
So it's been it's like very strange to me to watch it on Instagram and be like, I used to like run that.
That's really crazy.
But I was doing all that stuff and running all the logistics of the day-to-day of CTN and it, you know, doing all the work to get certified and, you know, in my spare time. And going back to school in my spare time. And then my husband and I got married and I had a daughter and COVID happened. So it's
it's been a lot. You know, it's so crazy that like you make such a good point that no matter how much we do, it's so easy to feel like we're not doing enough. And I know that because I never feel like I've accomplished anything in my life. Like
You're so cool. Like I just want to bask in your sisters.
I had lunch with an old friend like a while ago, and you know, in my eyes, like I'm not doing enough, or like I am doing maybe cool things, or not cool. I don't even like the word cool. I'm doing interesting things, but in my head, it's not good enough, or because I'm not technically certified in mental health. I'm just talking about it and inviting professionals on the podcast to talk about it with me. But I just have horrible imposter syndrome. And so, you know, I had a lunch with a friend a while ago and she was like, you're so accomplished. And
I was like, are you talking to me? Like, I was like, what are you talking about? But yeah, I constantly struggle with not feeling like I'm doing enough. So I do understand what you mean.
Yeah.
Something I really want to touch on is, so obviously, actually there's a lot I want to touch on, but you just said like so many amazing things. It's funny that you kind of said that you discovered more about your own mental health after you started this journey. Whereas for me, like I really got into the mental health space once I started therapy myself, and I realized that it shouldn't be so taboo. Yeah. And I was like, is nobody talking about this? Like, right. We're all going through it.
Right. Why are we all in therapy? We should all be in therapy.
Literally every single person should be in therapy. And don't get me wrong. I know there is a difference between like actual mental health illness,
right,
and just the everyday stresses. And I think sometimes those lines are kind of blurred and people are like, well, I don't know what anxiety actually is because does that just mean you're stressed about work? But,
right,
you know, there's definitely a spectrum and it wouldn't hurt for everyone to be in therapy. It's amazing.
Go ahead. If I can, I'll say,
yeah, no, please, please.
The way I describe it to people is like this, and I'll actually do, because you can see me, Sarah, so I'll do the example. Imagine that this is a mountain that you have to climb, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a mountain you have to climb. Now, if I'm just starting therapy before a crisis and without a diagnosed mental health issue, but I just want a non-biased professional to speak to about my issues, it's still a climb up a mountain. Mm-hmm. It is still hard work. Okay. Now, if you're climbing up that mountain when you're already in crisis or where things are already really bad for you, that's like pushing two huge boulders up the mountain. It's mm-hmm. just as much, if not more so. It's harder right. work, right? So there is a spectrum of, you know, at the bottom end of the spectrum, you have people who are struggling with real, serious, sometimes chronic, or I don't like to use the word permanent because I don't believe this is a permanent thing, but, you know, living with a diagnosed mental health condition. And then you have people on the opposite of the spectrum who are not, but does that necessarily mean that they're living in a state of mental, spiritual, physical, or metaphysical well-being? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Right, you don't have to be diagnosed with anxiety or depression to feel that the sadness in your life is getting in the way of your ability to function.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
totally, so, totally.
And if I can just say something to you and compliment you on what you're doing, really, because here's the thing: I think for the average person who is not familiar with this world, the idea of sitting down with a professional is daunting. There's a lot of assumed judgment that I hope, you know, that we hope is not there from the side of the practitioner, but we walk into that room with a lot of assumed, you know, what are they going to think about me? Are they going to judge me? How are my parents going to react to me? Et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's so beautiful about what you're doing with this podcast is that you, as someone who is so interested and engaged and thinks so highly of accessing and understanding our mental health, you are normalizing this for the average person in a way that I think that a lot of professionals struggle to. Because as soon as you put the professional hat on, oh, now there's a barrier between us.
Right.
And now you know more about me than I know about myself, and I'm not comfortable with you. But mm-hmm. for you, as someone who has learned through therapy and through mental health techniques to access your own well-being, right? You're speaking from lived experience without that professional hat on. I think it makes it more comfortable for people who are unfamiliar with this world to feel like, oh, I can dive in because Sarah's holding my hand and she's doing it alongside me, right? So
yeah, that's like literally the exact goal. Might use those words actually to tweak my about me section.
By all means, go ahead.
That's exactly what my goal is. So I really, really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You're doing amazing things.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. I want to touch on something that is a tricky topic, but I think it's important because you mentioned working in Jewish spaces and like, obviously both of us are Jewish, we're observant. And I think that there is, unfortunately still some type of stigma in some communities. I mean, you can disagree with me. I think it's getting a lot better. And I think that there's been so much growth recently, like even in my community on the Upper East Side, like my rabbi is trained in mental health. Things are really changing.
He did a mental health training at Chabad of the Upper East Side over the summer and it was amazing.
Oh, that's incredible. So things are definitely progressing. Listen, I don't want to make any assumptions, especially because anti-Semitism is like crazy right now. And I don't want to like fuel people's fire, but I definitely think like in certain, I mean, in most communities, there's still a stigma. In all communities, there's still a stigma. But, you know, in order to help communities, you kind of have to start in your own community and say like, what people are around me. So, exactly. You know, I think that when it comes to Judaism, like, especially in our communities, I think I've personally felt before, like, well, if I have faith and I believe in God, then like, why would I ever have anxiety?
Why would the bad things still happen to me?
Right, exactly. Or like, why should I be anxious about the future if I know everything happens for a reason? But the truth is like, you can be the most religious person and still really struggle with anxiety. 100%. And I want to talk about that.
100%. Because we are human beings in human bodies living in a physical world. Mm-hmm. So of course we're going to feel anxious. Mm-hmm. So but before I get into that, I just want to backtrack on something and address stigma as a whole and then narrow it down into our particular communities. I think what I'm seeing or what I've witnessed in the Orthodox Jewish community, at least in terms of stigma associated with mental health, really speaks to the stigma that it has existed historically on a societal level, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the history of mental health, it has always come in conjunction with stigma, with something wrong with you, with something wrong with your brain, with something wrong with your family, right? Anyone who was a little bit different, we made them an other. We made them other, we made them separate from us. And if you look at the history of how people with special needs were treated in the United States, I mean, a lot of people don't know that euthanizing mass amounts of individuals did not start in Hitler's Germany. It started in the United States 25 years before that, with euthanizing individuals or what's the other word I was looking for? They would my words are disappearing. They would sterilize them so they couldn't have more kids, right?
Wow.
Right. And this was happening in the 1920s in the United States. So for as long as we have had other, we have also had a way to deal with other, which is to shame, to blame, to disassociate, to disrespect and disregard. And I think that regardless of which community you live in, none of us are exempt from this, right? If a listener is listening right now and they come from a Catholic community, they can associate with this also, or a Muslim community, or an atheist, you know, an atheist background. It doesn't matter. I think everyone on a societal level has experienced this extreme of mental health conditions or things that make us separate from other people also say something bad about the person who's struggling, right? And I think that as a society, we've done a very good job of destigmatizing. I think we still have a long, long way to go. So on that note, though, here's what I'll say on this. It's so annoying because I usually have this picture with me everywhere I go and I don't have it with me right now. But a lot of people don't stop to think about the fact that in order to be a whole person and access whole wellness, spirituality is a portion of that. Meaning we have our physical health, we have our mental health, we have our social health, we have our financial health, right? And all of these aspects of health contribute to our overall well-being. Our spiritual health is a component of our overall well-being. You don't have to believe in God. You don't have to, you know, but believing that there's a higher purpose in the world and that you as an individual are not just being dragged on the conveyor belt of life and that there's a reason for you to be here and that your purpose matters, that contributes to our overall well-being. And we really can see, by the way, that people who lack that or people who don't believe that that's true for them really struggle to successfully maintain health in other areas of their life. Because the way you think about yourself and the overall purpose that you have in this world is going to affect how you behave, right? Mm-hmm. Now, on the topic of God and spirituality and, right.
Right, so, and we don't have to delve too much into it. Like, you know,
but I'll just say this. You can believe in God, right? I believe in God. I believe that God is taking care of me. I also believe as a physical being in a physical world, God gave us the tools to be able to access the things we need to help us stay safe. in the same way that I believe that the Torah, right, the Bible is a blueprint for our lives, I mm-hmm. also recognize and understand that God created an entire physical world for us to utilize and use. And that also means accessing therapy, physical health care, right? We wouldn't wait to go to a doctor for, you know, if you broke your leg, God forbid, you wouldn't wait 11 years to go see a doctor, right?
Right.
You wouldn't just wait and say, oh, but I believe in God, so my leg is going to heal, right?
Right.
You know, you right. have to take actions to take care of your body. That's what we're supposed to be doing in this world. And I think it's mm-hmm. the same way with having a spiritual connection to a higher power, to God, or whatever it is that you want to call it.
Right.
It really comes down to believing in the higher power and also believing that the higher power gave you tools to be able to access, to delve mm-hmm. into your own, you know.
Right. Right. Which I know. Yeah. Like some people refer to it as like the universe, or like the universe gives me what I need and like the energies. But, you know, regardless of what you believe in, I think you make such a good point that it's not, I mean, I agree with you, but I think like, if someone doesn't believe in God, or they don't even believe that like there's anything out there causing them to whatever, like, you know, I think having a purpose in life and having something that you feel that you're contributing to is so important.
Yeah.
Because if you're constantly searching for happiness alone, you're going to run out of it all the time.
Run out. And it's not only that, you know, the things that give us temporary happiness are great. And they're necessary for our well-being. And they also, like those little, you know, I like to call them dopamine hits. Those little dopamine hits of happiness give you the strength to be able to go to the next phase, the next phase, the next phase. But if that's all you're relying on,
mm-hmm.
it's like eating candy. The first, you know, if you have a big bag of candy, the first three candies are going to taste so magnificent. After a while, they're all going to start to taste exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how many you put in your mouth, or if they're sour or sweet, eventually they all start to melt together. And it's like, wait, I'm not even enjoying this anymore.
Right. So true. That's a great analogy.
Thank you. I don't even know where that one came from, but cool.
That's incredible. No, I totally agree with you. I think like I spent a really long time just seeking happiness without purpose, or without thinking about, you know, how I can contribute to this world, even helping others. Like I find that in moments where I'm helping others and I'm stepping out of myself and I'm stepping out of my own, like, and that's honestly why I'm doing this podcast. It's for other people. Obviously that's where it stemmed from. But even from like a selfish perspective,
right.
I literally need something that makes me feel like I'm doing something that's not for me in order to feel like this life is worthwhile and full, and I'm getting fulfillment. Like if I'm just doing things for myself and my job doesn't really include helping people, and it's like I go to work and then I come home and then I make myself food and then I go out with my friends, and it's like, where am I contributing? I just kind of feel empty. And I feel like this podcast is really why is really how I'm able to feel like I'm contributing and somehow I hope helping people, which is what gives me my meaning.
Yeah, no, 100%. And if I could bring it back, I'll bring it back to becoming a published author. At 21 years old, I had this idea in my head. This is what's going to make me happy. This is what's mm-hmm. going to give me that huge check mark that I'm looking for fulfillment. And you know what? It really did for about the first 6 months after the book was published. mm-hmm. And I'm laughing now. Because I'm looking at it now with 8 years of experience under my belt, and I can look back at my 21-year-old self and be like, wow, if I had known then what I know now, I don't think that the experience of becoming a published author would have burnt me out the way it did. But mm-hmm. like within a year after the book came out, I couldn't even promote it anymore because it just felt like vomit. Like I was mm-hmm. like, I feel so empty. Why do I feel so empty? I just did this huge thing and it should make me so happy. Why am mm-hmm. I not happy? And I think part of it was because I was doing a lot of, well, it's me, 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 right? And not necessarily looking out and being like, well, how could I use my talents to affect the world? And I think part of that is just being how young I was, right?
Because right.
like 21-year-olds are not really focused. Maybe the 21-year-olds that I work with now are very much more focused on helping other people than I was when I was that age. Mm-hmm. But at that age, it was very like, me.
Right.
And I think it came to becoming a suicide prevention educator, and also just like the personal experiences that I had to go through in my 20s really forced me to recognize that, I mean, I really, really, truly believe, and I say this without a shadow of a doubt, I think that the reason I'm here on this earth is to help people through writing. Like, wow. I mean, like, and this is actually what's been so interesting about being a suicide prevention educator, is using my skills to access and to help people in that way. But also, like, you know, the book I'm working on now, I've been working on for 7 years. And I think it was only, if the writing only started to really sing when I started to help other people. Because when, wow, I recognize that when I sit down in my page in the morning, it's not only about me and my amazing talent and what is my subconscious going to come up today. I sit down at my page, and I'll actually show you, Sarah, because I have my notebook here. I this thing is glued to me. I never go anywhere without it. I actually have a purse big enough to fit this in. I buy notebook size purses.
That's funny.
It. And it's so funny because I've been saying that for years. And then there's this book, actually, I'll show you because I have it right here, Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg. This book changed my life. And she writes about having purse-sized notebooks. And I was like, hey, me too. But every single day, it does not matter what I'm doing. If I'm working on a piece of fiction, if I'm writing a new program, if I'm about to take a crisis call, before I got on the podcast today, I sit down for 3 minutes and I write. And what I write is, God, please help me be able to channel my talents so that I can be helpful to other people. Because at the end of the day, my talents are great. But if I'm only using them to feed my needs and my desires and my ego, eventually I'm going to get bored.
Right.
It's not going to be fulfilling in the way that I would like it to be and that I know it can be, you know?
Mm-hmm. 100%. When you were younger, did you feel that writing was like a way? I mean, I don't know if you were thinking about mental health in the same way when you were younger, but did you use writing as like a way to kind of process your thoughts? Because I'm not a good writer, but I know that writing really helps me process my thoughts.
Okay, so Sarah, let me tell you something. First of all, you are a great writer. Don't tell yourself that you're not a good writer. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
The things that we say to ourselves influence how we think about ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
I really believe that innately, inherently, every single person on the planet has a gift within them to be able to channel and share their own stories, right? You don't have to be a writer, but you can write, right? Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting that you asked that question, because Shattered Illusions, my first novel, is basically one big mental health deep dive investigation. Like, that's what it is. So the premise of the book is four strangers who are living in a remote town in, I think I said it, in New Orleans, or like right outside of New Orleans. I can't even, I like made up a fictional town right outside of New Orleans. Four people who do not know each other, have no connection to each other, all witness a murder. And they get pulled into this investigation because they're the witnesses and they saw things, right? But the story itself is not so much about the investigation as it is about the internal workings and the psychological experiences of all of the people who are dealing with this experience. And there's one scene in particular. You know what's interesting? I have not actually read my novel in about 8 years. And the 10 year anniversary of its release is coming up next summer. And so I'm like gearing myself up to go back and start rereading it now so I can do promotional stuff for it. And I'm like, oh, I'm so nervous.
Yes, yeah.
Like, I've changed so much. So I'm almost scared to go back and look at it with like judgment, you know?
Right.
There's one scene in the book. There is an Orthodox Jewish character in the book. And there's one scene, actually the night where the murder happens, she witnesses the murder from a rooftop. She's sitting on her rooftop thinking about her life. And she has this really deep conversation with herself, basically, about how the fact that she's Orthodox and the fact that she believes in God doesn't stop her from being human and doesn't stop her from being in immense, immense amount of pain and considering and contemplating suicide.
Wow. Right? Wow.
And I had no background in suicide prevention education, no background in mental health, but I've always, always, always tried to write from the place of touching the core of like people's emotional lives. So that, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do with the book. That's what I hope I'm doing with the book I'm working on now. So
yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's so, that is crazy that you, you know, had a character speak about suicide before
I became a suicide. Literally, like, I wrote Shattered Illusions in high school. So I wrote it between the ages of 17 and 19.
And wow. That's.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. I basically didn't have a senior year of high school because I'd finished most of my requirements in 11th grade. And so I had 2 or 3 free periods every day of the week. And I was like, I will never forget this. The idea for Shattered Illusions came to me. I was in Israel with my family for my brother's bar mitzvah, and the idea just came to me. And I remember walking into my English class, second or third week of school, and saying to my English teacher, you know, I had this idea for a novel, but, you know, but I'm not a writer right now, so I'll write it in like 9 or 10 years after I get an MFA and once I'm like an adjunct writing professor. And she was like, that's BS. You either write it now or it's not happening. Like, wow. Don't. So, and I had two or three free periods every single day of the week. So that's how I got it done. I just sat and wrote during those 45-minute free periods. So, but it is pretty wild to look back now and think about how psychologically intense and intuitive the writing was, even though that's not where I was in my life at all. I had no background at that point whatsoever.
I love that she supported you in that. And I feel that a lot of times when people are younger, you know, the older people around them might say like, okay, you're very young, give it time, we'll see. But she really encouraged you like at a young age, which I think is so incredible.
Not only that, but she introduced me to other writers who I never met personally. They don't know me and I don't know them, but I consider them my personal mentors.
Wow. That's incredible. And she was your writing teacher?
She was my English teacher. This is the crazy thing. Wow. I had a teacher for the first 3 years of high school who left at the end of 11th grade. This teacher, Ms. Schulman, came in just for my senior year of high school. And then she left at the end of my senior year. She was in the school for 1 year. Wow. So Ms. Schulman, if you're listening, I love you and thank you so much.
You should send her this episode.
I really will. I will.
Speaking of support, do you feel that when you started this journey, people around you were supportive of you diving into the mental health space? No, I was really curious about
you. Not even a little bit. And I'll tell you why. Not because they didn't see the importance, but because they didn't think that this issue was affecting our particular community. Again, wow. I started, you know, there's this amazing quote, I can't remember who it is now, but it's, you know, if you want to change the world, start with yourself, then with your family, then with your community, then with your neighborhood, then with your da 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 da, da until you change the whole world. So yeah. I think it was the Lubavitcher Rebbe, actually. So I really began with looking at my community. And in my community, mental health was not being talked about 8 years ago. I mean, the fact that now I've taught in almost every single Orthodox Jewish high school in the tri-state, that I've taught rabbis, that I've taught community leaders, that I'm not even going to them anymore, knocking on doors and be like, hey, do you want to talk to me? They're coming to me. Wow. That's huge. Because yeah, that's 7 years ago, this was not being talked about. So, you know, on one hand, I could say like, yeah, no one was supporting me. But I will say this. There were two people, and actually I'll call them out now and I'll tell you who they were. There were two people who throughout this entire process were like, yeah, of course this is what you should be doing. Of course this is what we should be doing. One of them was Rabbi Yarden Blumstein. He's the Sitin Shliach, Sitin Rabbi and Friendship Circle Rabbi to Detroit, Michigan. And he was the one who told me about the program that I became certified in. And there was another rabbi, a rabbitson, Mrs. Tachtel from the University of Arizona, who at the event where a student approached me about her suicidal ideation for the first time, Mrs. Tachtel didn't overhear the conversation, but happened to be walking past us in the hallway as we were talking and came over to me 4 hours later and said, you know, I noticed earlier that the conversation you were having was a little bit, I noticed that it seemed a little bit heavy and I wanted to check in on you. And I was like, wow, you are an angel, because I don't know what to do right now. Can you help me? And she has been a Chabad Rebbetzin for over 25 years. And in her 25 years of doing this, has had to, you know, intervene in crisis interventions with her students. Mm-hmm. So she had firsthand real world experience. And she was like, okay, this is what we're going to do. And this is how we're going to help her. And it was so, you know, there was a lot of pushback. Let's be clear. But there were also steps along the way where people were so helpful. Just even in, you know, they said something to me, or they encouraged me to keep trying. And that, I think, is what pushed me to keep going, because the opposition is always going to be there. When you try something new, there's always going to be people telling you, don't do it. Mm-hmm. But I think it was the handful of people along the way who supported me, who offered me advice, who offered me resources when I didn't know what resources to look for. And these aren't necessarily people I'm in touch with now, but I'm so grateful that they were there in those particular moments to say, we can do this and we should be doing this. And here's how you can. So, you know, it's a both and thing.
Right. I had just started going to therapy, and I like was quietly telling people that I was going, like some of my friends, and they'd be like, I've been too. Or like, right. Oh,
but
my brother.
Talk about it.
Yeah. And I was like, I literally one day woke up and I was like, wait, we all go to therapy and we all think that we're the only ones in therapy.
Yep.
And like, I'm so grateful that there are few, but starting to be more people who are okay with the uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because it's those people who were okay with being a little bit uncomfortable and speaking about things that were taboo that have helped this conversation move forward in our respective communities.
100%. And I think, you know, it was an honor and a privilege to be the director of the Jewish Women's Resource Center at the University of Pennsylvania for 2 years. I just left that role at the end of June so that I could oversee the foundation full time, which was a big move and it was a hard choice to make. But, you know, but I worked with college students every day for 2 years. Most of them were Jewish, but some of them were not. And I can't tell you how many times a student would confide in me and, you know, then their best friend or their teammate from the rowing team or whoever it was, somebody would walk past and they would literally, it was like they changed the channel and the conversation would change.
Wow.
Because we're not, I think as much work as we've done in this as a society to destigmatize mental health, it's still something that feels very othered. And no matter how many people are going through it, I mean, Sarah, did you watch Encanto?
No, I didn't.
Oh my God, you have to watch it. Okay. It's basically an investigation into intergenerational trauma, and it's amazing. I recommend it to everybody. But there's a song, basically, in the movie, there's a family member who nobody talks to, and nobody basically no one acknowledges that he exists either. And the song is called We Don't Talk About Bruno. This song should be called We Don't Talk About Our Problems, because that's basically what it is. The whole family is like, we don't talk about this. We don't address this. This is not something we engage in. Okay, but it's only when we engage with the uncomfortable that we can make sense of our lives. I know that sounds really grandiose and maybe like a big undertaking, but it's true. The sooner we can look inside of ourselves, and that doesn't mean that all of us are struggling with something so serious, right? Mm-hmm. But we're human. And we shouldn't have to do it alone. And I think the fact that we've come to believe that we should be able to handle all of our stuff by ourselves, we weren't for literally thousands of years. So what makes us in 2022 think that we're any different than our community, you know, than our ancestors 1,000 years ago? Okay, we have more technology than they did. And we have access to better care, but we still need each other and we still should be relying on one another.
100%. On that, Thank you. On that note, actually, so I don't know how much you can share about this. I know that it's a very complicated, in terms of suicide prevention, I know that there's like a lot that someone would need to learn to be trained in, but like, is there one thing?
I could tell it to you in 60 seconds.
I was going to say, is there like one thing that our listeners can walk away with where if they have a friend or even themselves in crisis mode that they can do and help them with?
Yes. The first thing I'll say is this. Suicide is a symptom. It's not who the person is. And just because a person is in so much pain that they're considering suicide, it does not make them a bad person. And it doesn't mean that something's wrong with them. They are having an irrational reaction to an immense amount of pain. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is this. A lot of people think that you have to have years and years and years of experience to understand how to help people, but you really only need four things, okay? The first thing you need is awareness. Awareness of signs. Most people who are struggling with a mental health crisis are not going to tell their friends directly that they're struggling. Again, because there's so much shame associated with this issue that they would rather keep it quiet and suffer in silence than ask for help. However, they may indicate to us in ways that they speak, behaviors, language, actions, giving away their belongings. The first thing is about increasing our awareness of what an individual may be doing that's alerting us to the fact that they're struggling. The second thing is getting really comfortable with the uncomfortable and talking to them about it. Most people think, oh, if someone's suicidal, they'll just ask me for help directly, and I'm not going to actually ask them if they're struggling with suicide because it might make them kill themselves. That's not true. The more direct and honest you are with a person, the higher likelihood you have that they'll be honest with you. So again, awareness of the signs and asking directly if they're having thoughts of suicide. The third thing is what we like to call active listening. If a person is really in crisis and struggling, most times they're not looking for fixes or solutions. They're looking for someone who will hold space for them and acknowledge that their pain is valid, right? So in this step, what I like to do is I like to give my example is this. You validate their pain, you appreciate that they came to you, and then you refer them to someone who can keep them safe, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the last tool. So again, I'm going to repeat them. Awareness, direct communication, engaging in active listening and acknowledging and validating their pain. And then the last thing, and I think the most important, is making sure that they have a network of safety that's not only you, that you're mm-hmm. connecting them together with you, right? Not on their own, but with your guide, you know, with your help, or even while you're sitting next to them, calling an anonymous suicide prevention hotline, calling a warm line, getting on the phone with a mobile crisis unit. A lot of people think you immediately have to go to the hospital. That's actually not the safest choice for everybody. For some people, a hospital might be necessary, but getting a professional or a volunteer on the phone who could help you assess the next steps and mm-hmm. also help create a sense of safety for the person in crisis and also for the person who's helping them, right? So it's hard, you know, it's hard work, but yeah. these four things, right? Just learning to pay more attention to what people are saying to us and not being afraid to address what we see. Not being mm-hmm. afraid to say, I see that you're really down. I see that you're talking, you know, I hear you talking about death or dying in joking ways, but I'm also concerned that maybe there's something more serious going on here. And I feel compelled to ask you, you know, are you having thoughts of suicide? And not jumping back if they say yes, but making disclosure is good news. If someone tells you they're suicidal, that means they're opening up their doors for you. They are trusting you. It's a good thing. So knowing that, that gives us the opportunity to help, be mindful, be appreciative of their pain, and also assess, well, now who can we go to help keep you safe for longer. So mm-hmm. And for anyone who's interested in learning more, you're welcome to join any of our workshops.
Yeah, I was going to say, please let our listeners know, like, you know, if they want to get trained in suicide prevention, where can they go? And B, if they want to get involved with the Gelt Charitable Foundation, or if they just want to find you or the Gelt Charitable Foundation on Instagram.
Great. So our handle on Instagram is @Gelt Charitable Foundation. My handle
that's Gelt, G-E-L-T.
Yep, like Gelt, like Hanukkah Gelt. Yep. My handle is Lee Est, L-E-I-G-H-E-S-T. And if you're interested in participating in or hosting a suicide prevention workshop, if you'd like to bring a workshop to your community or school or synagogue or church or work environment, reach out to us on social media. You can also email us at info@geltcharitable.foundation. And we'll set up a workshop for you. I travel all over the tri-state, and we travel out of the tri-state if we get a request for larger workshops also. So we were just in Chicago. We're going to be in California next week. This is honestly what I love to do the most in the world. So if you guys are interested, hit me up and let's make it happen and let's help more people.
100%. This is open to anyone.
Listen, I'll end with this. Last summer, we had the most incredible life-changing opportunity. The Gelt Charitable Foundation was contracted by the Boston Fire Department to lead 7.5 weeks of suicide prevention trainings. That's 72 or 78 workshops for 1,500 firefighters over 7 weeks. Most of them are, South Boston, tatted up Catholic guys, right? Uh-huh. It was the best experience of my life. Everyone is struggling and everyone needs support. And I think I learned more from the firefighters in those few weeks than I have in 4 years of school. If you're listening and you need help, or you think someone needs help, if we might end with this, I'll give the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention.
Yes. Program. Yes. Amazing.
I think it's a blessing and a curse that I don't have it memorized yet. I was going to say, I should know it by heart by now. But so the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, 800-273-8255. And if you're interested in bringing a suicide prevention workshop to your community, doesn't matter where you are, we will make it happen. This is what we do, and we want to be as helpful to as many people as we can. And Sarah, thanks for really giving me the opportunity to share about the work that we're doing. And you're just the coolest person ever, and I want to bask in your coolness forever.
You're the coolest. I'm so happy we're friends now, and thank you so much. You're incredible. I'm really honored that you came on this podcast, and I'm really grateful that there's people like you out there doing this work, because it's so necessary and you're changing the world literally. So thank you so much, and I will talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
That was my episode with Lee. As you heard, she is amazing and so wise and is doing incredible things. And I was really happy to have her on the podcast. As you might remember, this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. And what is BetterHelp, you might ask? It is an online therapy service. So if you are in the market looking for a professional therapist, a mental health counselor, BetterHelp is the place for you. I know this was a heavy topic, and I can understand feelings that may arise from the episode. I do want to clarify that BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's professional therapy done securely, and you can start communicating with a therapist in under 48 hours, but it is not the same as a suicide hotline. But BetterHelp is amazing, and you can find thousands of mental health professionals on there. And you'll be paired with one. I've been in therapy online now for 2 years since the pandemic started. And I honestly feel that it is the same as in person. I find it so helpful. So I really recommend BetterHelp. As you may remember, my code is betterhelp.com/itsfine. That's betterhelp.com/itsfine for 10% off your first month of service. As always, you can find the podcast at It's Fine, I'm Fine Pod on Instagram and on Twitter. It's Fine, I'm Fine PD. My personal channels, Sarah L. Sassone on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. Trying to make more mental health content on TikTok. If you want to go support me, that would be awesome. And it might be cringy, but bear with me. And that's it for today.
thank you so much for listening. And if you've made it up until here, I appreciate you. And there's always resources for you out there if you need help. And the final thing I'll say really quickly is that I apologize if the audio was a little bit weird today. I feel that when I listened back, it sounded kind of wonky. And I'm not going to let that happen again. So thanks for listening and talk to you next time. Bye.